We'll cycle into the October 27, 2012 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report. Few would argue that Cycle 24 has been a propagational bust. One ham who has studied solar cycles for some years is Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA. At the 2012 Dayton Hamvention, Carl gave a paper entitled Propagation Topics for Cycle 24. Here's an excerpt from his talk.
Here's some recent Cycle 24 data. We had a minimum in about December 2008. The first sunspots for Cycle 24 occurred around in January of 2008. And then nothing happened for a while, but finally, in mid-2009, things started picking up, and cycle 24 did start rising. The monthly means for cycle 24 are very dynamic. Generally, there are a couple months where the monthly means just keep rising, and then that's followed by a couple months when they're not too much. That's pretty typical of a solar cycle ascent, so it's nothing to, you know, get worried about. But what's happened recently, as you can see in the data, around November and December, we had some really high monthly means, and as expected, the monthly means after that went down a little bit, but they kind of stayed down and didn't come back up too much, and what the result of that is the smooth sunspot number kind of leveled off around 60. Now, if that bothers you, all you can do is maybe multiply that times 3 and you can feel better. So, okay. That won't help too much really, though. So is this just a temporary slowdown, or have we reached the peak of cycle 24? Cycle 23, just like other solar cycles, appear to reach a little plateau, and you may think that, well, it's done, we're here. But then it started going again. So we're just going to have to wait and see what happens with cycle 24. Here's the International Space Environment Service prediction. They're predicting 90, smooth sunspot number of 90. Remember, we're about kind of stuck at 60 right now, so we got a way to go, hopefully. The monthly means really have to start picking up in the next several months to get that smooth number to rise up to 90. Do we know if it's going to happen or not? Not really. The Marshall Space Flight Center solar scientists kind of think, well, we might be there. Their prediction is nominally for 60. They have uncertainty of almost up to 90 and down to something like 40, of course, which we've exceeded already. So all we can do is, if you're a high band HF enthusiast, we can only hope that the monthly averages are going to keep going and we'll get some more activity, and that'll push the smooth sunspot number up. You know, you can plot all this data in terms of the 10.7 centimeter solar flux also, and it follows similar trends. The monthly means are bouncing up and down. The smooth is leveled off just like the smooth sunspot number. Okay, here's four cycle 24 frequently asked questions. Now, I don't know how frequently they're asked, but I asked them once, so that's good enough for me. And we're going to call them frequently asked questions. Let's go over each one of those. Will cycle 24 have two peaks? Well, if we look back at cycle 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23, we'll see that 19, 20, and 21 really didn't show much of a second peak. 19, of course, we didn't need a second peak. It was the biggest one in our recorded history. 20 and 21, they didn't show much of a second peak either. But cycle 22 certainly showed a second peak. Cycle 23 definitely showed a second peak. In fact, cycle 22's second peak was even higher than its first peak in terms of solar flux, which is a bit better indication of what the sun's doing, and that gave the 6-meter DXers really good propagation in the winter of 2001. Will cycle 24 have a second peak? Well, there's certainly a chance, and if it does happen, it probably will prolong the higher band propagation conditions. Is there going to be any 6-meter F2 for cycle 24? Well, we have to realize that the world isn't uniform. If we consider the equatorial ionosphere or paths that stay at low latitudes, we'll probably see lots of F2 in terms of not only just pure F2, but also in terms of trans-equatorial propagation. I think there's also been reports of that already for cycle 24. It's because the equatorial ionosphere is just very robust, even at solar minimum. So even though cycle 24 may be an underachiever, we'll probably see some 6-meter F2 propagation. What we likely won't see is F2 to Europe, F2 to Japan, or anything like that. But if it does happen, it'll happen in the spring, fall, and the winter months, probably of next year. So let's have to wait and see what happens. If cycle 24 picks up and keeps going up a little bit more, we may have a chance. But of course, the only way to catch those is to be there all the time and really monitor it. Of course, sporadic E will likely be here this summer and throughout the rest of the summers for cycle 24. Late morning, early evening hours in the summer, late early evening in the December time frame. Okay, here's a good one. Are sunspots disappearing? There was an article several years ago. Two scientists, Livingston and Penn, measured the maximum strength of magnetic fields around sunspots, and they've noted that the strength has been decreasing since 1992. That's when their measurements began. That's when they started collecting data on this, or we were able to collect data on this. Now, combine that with the fact that you need about 1,500 Gauss for sunspots to be visible, and that leads to an extrapolation that we're not going to see any sunspots maybe 2015 or 2016 or so. There's been an update to the data. In fact, it was a 2012 update, and that declining trend appears to still be continuing. So what does that mean? Well, that's an interesting question. We have to remember that sunspots and 10.7 centimeters solar flux is just a proxy for the true ionizing radiation. And right now, the true ionizing radiation, which is extreme ultraviolet, still seems to be behaving well and is going good. So we'll have to see what happens. It'd be interesting to look at this data as it gets updated. It is updated on a regular basis by a solar scientist in, let's see, where is he? He's one of the Norwegian countries. Okay. So that begs the question, are we going to enter another Maunder minimum? That's probably the most well-known minimum of all the grand solar minimums. It was named after the guy who kind of discovers it, Maunder. It was a lack of sunspots from 1645 to 1715. And what happened was cycles minus 11, minus 10, and minus 9 showed a smooth decrease as we approached the Maunder minimum. You don't hear the term cycle minus 11, cycle minus 10. That's because as we dig into old records and reconstruct solar activity, we can get a good idea what happened before our solar cycles officially started with cycle 1. And that's what the negative this means. It's very early on. It's generally agreed that the sun is slowing down, so we'll have to see what happens. Cycle 22, 23, and 24 are showing a gradual decrease also. Cycle 22 is about 160 for a smooth sunspot number. 23 was about 121. 24, 60, 90, something like that. So there's a smooth decrease. We'll just have to see what cycle 24 does and what the minimum between 24 and 25 looks like, and then maybe we can tell what's going on.
You're listening to Propagation Topics for Cycle 24, a paper presented at the 2012 Dayton Hamvention by veteran solar cycle enthusiast Carl Lutzelschwab, K9 LA. We'll conclude our excerpt from his talk in a moment. This is The Rain Report, available 24/7 at therainreport.com.
Last year, Larry, W8VVG, was here, and he talked about the Waller flag. The Waller flag was is credited to Doug and X4D. That's where the name Waller came from. It included some comments from N4IS down in Florida. In summary, what he said was the horizontal Waller flag worked best when receiving signals from the south, southeast, and southwest. The vertical Waller flag works better to the north and sometimes to the east and west, but never to due south. So that was kind of interesting, and it kind of proves some of the theory that we understand about the ionosphere. And let's just go over that real quickly, because there is a relevant practicality to it. What it all revolves around is the fact that there is more order to polarization than we generally acknowledge, and that's because the ionosphere is immersed in a magnetic field. Yeah, I put a comment in there that the ionosphere is very dynamic and things change, but there still is more order than we realize. At HF, if you've read some recent QST articles by KL7AJ, circular polarization is the norm. But down on 160, highly elliptical polarization is the norm, and it's tending towards linear polarization. So what that kind of says is your location really determines on, especially on 160, what polarization you really should use to couple into the ionosphere. Now, along with that, down on 160, the extraordinary wave suffers significantly more absorption than the ordinary wave. Okay, we got to remember, when we transmit, our polarization, whether it's vertical or horizontal, is not what propagates through the ionosphere. What propagates through the ionosphere are two characteristic waves, the ordinary and the extraordinary. And our job with our antennas is to try and couple best into the one that we want it to couple into. So what this all boils down to is really the orientation of the magnetic field and where our RF first encounters the ionosphere. Now, if we're at mid and high latitudes, our RF usually encounters the ionosphere maybe 1,000 kilometers down the road. And mostly the magnetic field is more vertical than horizontal, which says that we should really use vertical polarization on 160 because we need to couple everything into the ordinary wave because that's the only one left. But at low latitudes, you know, just visualize someone down in Florida and he's looking towards the south. Well, that's where the magnetic field is very horizontal. So that's why he observed that the horizontal flag was much better towards the south, southeast, and southwest, you know, his long paths to Southeast Asia, et cetera. So the takeaway from this is if you're down at low latitudes and you're listening to stations that come in from the southeast, south, and southwest, you may want to try horizontal polarization. You may be surprised that there's a definite improvement. Now, this should also apply on transmit, too. Maybe there's some interesting experiments for someone to try. The last topic was anomalies in the F2 region. You know, we know a lot about the F2 region. Our model in our propagation programs is a monthly median model, and we can generally predict F2 propagation pretty well over a month's time frame. But there's a lot of short-term stuff that still happens that we can't explain. And here are some anomalies that are kind of well-known in the ionospheric community. The equatorial anomaly, you know, this gives us trans-equatorial propagation. What happens is there are two clumps of very dense electrons on either side of the geomagnetic equator. We kind of know quite a bit about it, so we can't really call it an anomaly anymore, but it's still called the equatorial anomaly. Another anomaly that we kind of know a lot about, but it's kind of still called an anomaly, is the winter or seasonal anomaly. And that's when the daytime MUF, the maximum usable frequency at a mid-latitude in winter, is higher than the daytime MUF at a mid-latitude station in the summer. You know, that's contrary to solar zenith angle. You know, you'd think in the summer, since the sun's more overhead, there'd be more ionization, but there isn't. Of course, what that shows is that solar radiation is just the instigator of ionization, but there are other factors that determine what the ultimate ionization is. So that's just something to know. And, of course, it leads to why the CQ Worldwide contests are so good in the 10-meter contest, because the MUFs during the day are higher in the winter-type months than the summer months. Also note, way on the left side, 0100, 0200, 0300 UTC, that the summer MUF at night is a little bit higher than the summer MUF during the day. That's kind of interesting. Normally you think that the MUF is going to be highest during the daytime. And that leads us to the next anomaly. It got its name because it was discovered down in Antarctica, where the Weddell Sea is. In that area, the F2 region maximizes during the night, not during the day. It's really bigger than the Weddell Sea. It also includes the Bellingshausen Sea, I believe it's called. So that's a big area down there, but unfortunately, there's probably not a lot of hams down there to take advantage of it. One of the more interesting ones is what's called a single-day day sign enhancements. And the authors who did this research looked at worldwide data from 1958 to 2006. They only reported results over Europe because it was a massive project to get started. And they said they'd probably look at the North American sector. They haven't done that yet. But what they saw in 1958 to 2006, there were 890 events where the MUF increased by about 1.5 times the 30-day centered median value. And that's more than the day-to-day variation of the F2 region. They found that it was confined to about 60 to 90 degrees of longitude, you know, a certain width. Mostly happened in the morning local time and occurred from mild to moderate geomagnetic activity, mostly during the equinox months at solar minimum. So here's an anomaly that we don't really understand very well, but it happens. And what it can do, of course, is give us some interesting propagation that we had no idea would be there. Our propagation models don't include these short-term events, so it's very surprising when they happen. It's very tough to understand and explain them. One specific example I have is when N2MF worked 3B7C on 10 meters at, in the morning hours in September 2007. You know, that was around solar minimum, 10 meters solar minimum. How did that happen? None of our models show anything should have happened, but it could have been because of this single day enhancement. So the takeaway here is that there are lots of things that happen in the F region we don't understand yet. We have a pretty good idea on average of what's going on, but there's still very short-term events that happen. And if you just sit by your radio a lot, you'll probably discover them. So here's a summary. The smooth sunspot number and the smooth 10.7 centimeter solar flux of cycle 24 has leveled off. Is this temporary or are we at the peak? Well, we'll just have to wait and see then. Cycle 24 thankfully has a decent chance of two peaks, and hopefully that'll prolong propagation on the higher bands. 6 meter F2 in the equatorial regions is probably not going to happen, or it's a very low probability. We'll still have F2 probably at low latitude pass, you know, like us to VK. That's still quite a low latitude path, so be aware that that could happen. We may see sunspots disappear, but that may not mean anything. It's interesting to think of the Maunder minimum. When sunspots disappear, we always say, well, if the sunspots went away, there's no ionosphere. But remember, sunspots are just the proxy for the true ionizing radiation, so it could be that the ionosphere was still just working fine. It's just that the sunspots were not visible. Tied to that is, it's just too early to say what's going to happen if we're going to enter another grand minimum. We've had quite a few in the past, so we're probably due for another one. And F2 regions give us some unusual openings, so just be aware of them.
Carl Lutzelschwab, K9LA, excerpted from his 2012 Dayton Hamvention paper, Propagation Topics for Cycle 24. For more background about Carl and his solar studies, Google K9LA. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2012 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for all connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Rain Report, www.therainreport.com.